there was probably a lot of music in your family before you even started to play. What kind of music was your family involved with?
Well, my Aunt Andre used to play a lot of boogie-woogie piano, and I had a couple of other aunties that also played pretty much like boogie-woogie style stuff in New Orleans, Dixieland. And I had a couple of my uncles that played a little blues piano, but just regulation New Orleans variations of music.
Your father ran, well, he co-owned a studio, right?
He owned an appliance company that dealt with a lot of selling records to Dillard University in New Orleans, which, fortunately for me, they sold a lot of, like, bebop records. They sold a lot of rhythm and blues records, which in those days were called race records, and they sold a lot of hillbilly records, and that was pretty much the music of that time.
What was his relationship to the studio? I thought he was co-partner.
He worked with Cosmo. They had a deal where they serviced the black hotels on South Rampart Street for the 78 records for the jukeboxes, and which I luckily inherited. When they'd take them out of the hotels, I would get to keep all these great 78s. So I had a great collection of, like, Memphis Mini and Big Bill Brunzi records and, you know, like, real classic stuff with King Oliver and Louis Armstrong's A Little Child.
Did you go to the Mardi Gras as a child?
Sure.
What are some of your first impressions of that?
Well, my whole thing that I always loved from the very jump was the Mardi Gras Indians at the Mardi Gras. They were just like... there were tribes in our neighborhood. When I was a kid, they had the Third Ward Terrorists, and they had the Creole Wild West, and all these Indians would come parading down what they called the greens, that were like little grassy knolls in between the divided the streets, and they'd come riding on horseback, some of them, or most of them on foot. And just seeing whole tribes just coming down, and these real frightening wild men from the tribes would just scare us little kids away with they had these big, like, coconuts and alligators and pieces of animals all over them, and they were made up to look so frightening and exciting. I just got hooked on the Indians from just childhood, you know. They were so beautiful to look at and so different.
What kind of music did they play?
Well, they would do all these Indian songs like Iko Iko. They did like Me Donkey Like Shallow Water. A lot of songs that I later know now are some like Calypso kind of songs. And the music of the Wild Chapatulas and the Wild Magnolias album gives a good idea of what the Indian music is. And a few of the songs that I've recorded over the years, like Big Chief, Iko Iko, are typical Mardi Gras Indian songs.
Which was the first instrument you started to play?
Well, I played the piano and the bass and the drums, but I started studying guitar. And that was the first instrument that I worked on professionally. And when I was about 13 or 14, I got a work permit that my parents got me so I could work in the clubs, and at that time I was just concentrating on the guitar. I still like to play the piano, but I worked for many years as a studio guitarist, and that was my real love at that time.
If you were playing clubs and studios when you were a teenager, you probably weren't spending that much time going to school. Did you skip out on school a lot?
Well, I'd go, but I mostly would sit in class and write song lyrics. And I would try to, that was where my head was at. I was really like into a lot of the songs that I wrote in class back then were songs that were recorded later on. And
can you name a couple?
Well, Lights Out by Jerry Burns on a specialty album, This Is How It All Began. And several of those Art Neville and Jerry Burns songs that are on those specialty albums from the 50s of the Rock and Roll This Is How It All Began series. Carry On by Jerry Burns. Art Neville did What's Going On. It's on another one of those series of albums. But at that time, those were some of the ones that I had. There were several other ones that aren't documented on any records, so that's why I'm not bringing those up.
Was there any pressure on you to play less music and go to school more or pay more attention while you were there?
Not really. I was not doing so well in school that my family thought that they didn't see a lot of hope for me. And, like, I wasn't getting good enough grades to show any talent for anything but playing music. So they kind of encouraged me, if I was going to do something good, they encouraged me all the way to go with it. So they even let me go on the road as a young kid, because they trusted the older guys that I worked with, and they felt like, you know, I was safe with these guys.
Were you?
Yeah. These guys really were, like, a lot older and looked out for me as they all looked the kid, you know, and, like, even the things that they did behind my parents' back that my parents would have croaked if they knew about or something, and it was all things that were good education for me and learning what not to do. Let me learn about mistakes and things, and these guys really looked out for me and were great teachers. I was blessed to have, over the years, my guitar teachers from Papoose Nelson, who was Fats Domino's guitarist, and Ron Montrell, who was one of the top studio guitar players in New Orleans. They were not only great guitar teachers, but they were great innovators in areas of the music. And they all played for Professor Longhair, which was another thing they kind of, everybody turned me towards Professor Longhair, and at what time I was able to play guitar for him, it turned me on to not only rhythmic things, but how rhythm sections work.
How did you meet Professor Longhair? Are there any stories about you camping out on his steps until he'd spend some time with you?
Well, my first meeting of him when I was a real young kid, my father was fixing a PA system. And I remember I was supposed to wait in the car while he did this by this club. And I had wandered out behind the club, and there was this guy sitting on a log. And I went over and was talking to him and didn't know that he was Professor Longhair. But he was, I knew he was the piano player that worked there. And I was asking him about the piano, and he would say, well, oh, those are double note crossovers and over and unders. And I'd never heard expressions like that, you know, referring to music. But it was all his own words and descriptions of what he did. And he hooked me right away, even though I didn't meet him again or see him for years after that. I just heard his records and stuff after that. But anytime I'd see his name, I'd check it out, you know. He left such a big influence on me. And when I started working for him later, it was like a real thrill, because we were, myself and the guys that went with his band, we were working with Rod Brown's band at Lincoln Beach in New Orleans, and Longhair came and said he had a gig for us, and we just quit Rod Brown on the spot. We didn't give him a 2-week notice. We didn't do anything. We just went. And it was the best thing we ever did, because it was like a real school. And I always look fondly back on those times.
My guest is Dr. John MacRebinack. I should ask you what you'd prefer to be called.
It doesn't matter. It's all me.
Okay. When you were playing clubs when you were 13 or 14, you were still underage and probably weren't legally allowed in the clubs.
No, I had a work permit from my family that made it legal.
So you could get in, but you couldn't drink.
Right.
Did you drink anyways? Were there ways of getting drinks to you?
Well, if I would have wanted to, but it wasn't too cool. The guys that I worked for, they were like really against drinking on the jobs. They would drink a lot after the gigs. But during the gigs, it was like a real strict environment in those days. These guys were like real sticklers about a lot of things.
What was the club scene like?
It was pretty wild and crazy. It was like, you know, most of the clubs were fronts for something else. It was like the you know, they would, the bee drinkers and all, working prostitution out the backs of the clubs. They all had these motels connected to them. There was gambling going on, like in all these hidden rooms around the clubs. And it was all pretty, like, what was great about it was it left the club owners hired bands that played music that they liked. And there was a lot of freedom. So bands in those days did not have to play for the public. They played for club owners that enjoyed music. And what happened, there was a lot of clubs that had bebop music or different forms of music that was great for musicians who weren't under pressure to pack people in a club. Because these guys didn't even care if there was any people necessarily in the club, because that's not where their money was necessarily coming.
Were there a lot of knife fights or gun fights at some of the rougher clubs that you played?
Oh, yeah. Some of the joints were real, you know, typical bucket of blood joints. And there was some of the places that my family knew I was working, and some of them would have just pulled me out the whole scene. I mean, there was nights that guys would push me behind, like these one-armed bandits, you know, those slot machines, and would use them like shields and shove me behind them when they'd see the guns come out and stuff. And, like, man, it was a night, you know, that somebody got shot, stabbed or whatever, and there's a lot of bouncers in the clubs would get overly protective of the club, and next thing you know, there's somebody going to the hospital. And it was pretty much in certain areas of New Orleans, like there were more strips of music. Well, like today there's only Bourbon Street and Fat City left of the old musical scene in New Orleans. Well, in my childhood, there was like LaSalle Street had a strip where the Dew Drop Inn and all of the famous black clubs were, and St. Charles Avenue had a strip where all of the famous white clubs were. But there was other strips in New Orleans and various parishes that were outside of New Orleans that were much really swanky gambling clubs and stuff that were really more like Vegas, but not as as plastic as Vegas.
If the guns or the knives were coming out, were you supposed to keep playing?
Yes, we always were instructed to play loud and fast when trouble happened. That was kind of the rule of thumb. When trouble start, you play loud and fast.
What was that supposed to accomplish?
Drown out the trouble.
Oh, did it work?
Yeah.
So people wouldn't notice that much what was happening?
Yeah, so the bouncer could clear the people out the place, and usually nobody was the wiser that somebody was murdered or whatever happened. It was usually not even noticed by the bulk of the paying people.
Was there a separate black and white music scene when you were coming of age?
Well, there were separate unions. There was segregated unions, which was a real problem for me because especially as I was working in a recording scene, I had flack from the white union for hiring black musicians. I had flack from the black musician about hiring white musicians. So both unions were giving me trouble for hiring the other guys when what I was doing was trying to hire the best guys to fill the jobs. And it was not only problems for me, but everybody at certain times along the way that were doing things with mixed groups felt this problem.
Was it difficult to play in an integrated band because
of
that?
Well, it was, put it this way, we were pretty cool in certain sections of New Orleans. When we get out of those sections, we were crazy enough to do it, but we were not very smart to do it because from parts of New Orleans east going to Mississippi and Alabama, there was a lot of racial trouble going on during those days. And I mean, literally, sometimes traveling with Huey Smith's band, we actually saw lynching. And I mean, traveling with a mixed group of people through that was very frightening.
My guest is Dr. John MacRebenack. It seems to me that you got involved really with a lot of black musicians, given the frequently segregated nature of the music scene in New Orleans. How did you fall in with the black musicians who you did?
Well, from early on, I started working with a guy named Leonard James, a tenor player that he introduced me early on to, like, we'd work at a club called a Cadillac Club. Well, this is where Fats Domino's band played. And fortunately for me, I met one of my guitar teachers there, Papoose Nelson. I had been studying from a white guitar teacher prior to that, a guy named Al Goma. And all of a sudden, I met this guy. And through Papoose, I would meet more and more people. I started bringing people by the house, and we would have jam sessions, and caused a lot of problems for my family by me bringing all these black people over and playing music and all. It wasn't the coolest thing to do. But at the time, later, we had other places we could go jam, and it got much cooler. But early on, I didn't realize how much problem I was causing by doing a lot of things for a lot of people. It was just, to me, just having fun and playing music. But the police didn't dig all of this. They thought we were doing all kind of illegal things. And a lot of the times that I brought, by me being a white guy working in some black clubs, I put heat on clubs that police were, you know, what is this guy doing here? And there were even places where they'd hide me behind curtains and stuff, and vice versa. When it'd be like maybe one black guy working in a group, he was maybe hidden behind a curtain or something so that it wasn't noticed. So we got around a lot of these things by subterfuge.
Did it affect your relationships with them to have all this other stuff going on?
Well, it just added a little tension at times, but we were all into the music, and that was the tie that bonded us together so deeper than any of the other stuff that it... I mean, we took many chances at times where record labels would send us out with whole package shows that were phonies, where we were imitations of Shirley and Lee, and imitations of Little Richard and Chuck Berry, and all of these people prior to the days when they got on American Bandstand and TV shows. Nobody knew the difference. And by being mixed shows, being as fraudulent, we were really pushing things to a limit without realizing it.
How did you start doing studio work?
Well, I hung at the studio, myself and James Booker and several of the musicians. As kids, we just literally hung at the studio hoping somebody would get sick or get hurt and that we'd get the sub for them. And, I mean, literally, we made, you know, novenas to the saints that somebody would get ill, that we'd get a chance to play. And we'd wait. And occasionally, somebody would be late, and we'd get to play for a little bit. And usually they'd come, and we'd get shooed out again. But slowly but surely, we kind of got accepted into the clique. And it was like, I think, more to do with persistence than talent, you know.
This is, when you were playing for the studios, it was really about the time that rock and roll was really getting started, and that people were realizing the kind of rock and roll rhythms that were really indigenous to New Orleans.
Well, at the time I kind of came into the picture, I think rock and roll really started in the 40s and all before that, but it was a change of rhythms that today we accept as what is rock and roll rhythms, but that was being invented at that time. And it's kind of an offshoot of Professor Longhair's, like, calypso mixture with Latin rhythms to the old shuffle rhythms of rock and roll prior to that, where there were these eighth note rhythms that were much more related to Latin music or Afro-Caribbean music that was being created at that time. And there were just certain drummers that, like Earl Palmer and Charlie Williams, that kind of created this around Professor Longhair's rhythms and would use this with other people. And by using this rhythm, all of a sudden there was a new beat that people could dance to. And today it's like in every rock music you hear, but it, back then this was something totally new. And it was real comical because at first most of the drummers couldn't play it. There was only one or two guys, and then slowly it began to grow. And by within a few years, like, all of the drummers were playing it and going on to newer things.
What are some of the sessions that you played on that became big hits nationwide?
Well, early on, some of the Huey Smith and the Clowns things and Frankie Ford sessions and Jimmy Clanton sessions. Those were the original, Joe Tex records. And early on, I try to mention artists more than the songs because there were so many songs we would do. With Huey Smith, it's funny, I listened to some of the records that we had done, and I don't know what I played on them because Huey Smith would take me as a guitarist and say, play a conga part or play a bongo part. And I've played more things on records as a guitarist that don't sound like a guitar than I did that sound like a guitar.
I want to play a recording from your Gumbo album, and it's Those Lonely, Lonely Nights. What did you choose to do this song?
Well, I was looking for some Earl King songs. Earl King was one of the writers with the Ace Records out of Jackson, Mississippi, the Huey Smith and the Clowns, and all of us were like a family. And Earl was one of them. He and Huey Smith were two of the guys that encouraged me to keep on writing songs. And they were like the up-and-coming guys, Huey Smith was the young piano player coming up at that time, and Earl King was called Little Guitar Slim, who was the hero of the guitars at the time.
And why don't we hear it? You're featured on piano and vocals.
Right.
On this recording of Those Lonely, Lonely Nights from Dr. John Mac Rebinack's album, Gumbo.
There's been some lonely, lonely nights. Oh, baby, yes, since you've been gone. Lay my head on my pillow. Oh, how I cried all night long. The things you used to say to me.
Those Lonely, Lonely Nights with my guest, Dr. John Mac Rebinack, featured on piano and vocals. When you started producing records, I think at Ace Studios, the studio that you referred to.
It was Cosmo Studio before Ace Records.
Did you have a sound in mind that you were always going for?
When I first started, I didn't know what I was doing. I was such a kid that got into things before I was ready. I was like the original learning on the job experience guy. All I knew was if I hired the best musicians, I got the best arranger, and got the right songs for the right singer, I had did my job correctly. Then all I had to do was get everybody to play it right in the studio, make sure we got a good tape, and my job was finished then. And it wasn't about so much getting a sound, to me it was getting a feeling. Once we had a track that felt good, that was it. It was like, because it was all one track recording, there was no overdubs till a few years later. We began to overdub machine to machine. We didn't have two track machines then. But the thing was, mistakes or not, anything went as long as it had a good feeling. If you could dance to it, if it made you. We could tell on the playbacks whether we had something good, because the musicians would all start dancing if it felt real good. If they didn't get up and dance, no matter how tired it was, at least some of them would always dance if it was felt right. If that didn't happen, we'd go on and do it again.
Did you ever have musicians from up north being sent down to the studio that you worked in to get the kind of rhythm backing and arrangements that you had been able to get on your records?
Well, a lot of acts would come down, like, say, when the Chess Brothers would come from Chicago to New Orleans, they would bring, like, a lot of their acts to record in New Orleans. And what at some point, I think it was Mercury Records early on, started filtering in certain guys like Shelby Singleton and Danny Kessler that were record producers from New York and other places. And what they would do would maybe bring a guitarist or bring one guy in, maybe an arranger or something. Like, I can remember Barney Kessel coming to New Orleans and producing records under, he wouldn't even use Barney Kessel as a name then. I think he was under the name of Slug Murphy or something, but he didn't want his name on those dates. But people like that would come in, and we'd do a lot of fun sessions. But what we didn't realize was a lot of these guys would take some stuff that we were doing and kind of analyzing it and trying to use this in other ways. And it got to be a real competitive scene where at Ace Records, we started analyzing other people's records. Like out of Cincinnati, there was a very hip label. Sid Nathan had a company called King and Federal Records, and they were competing with us in our own territory. We didn't sell many records above the Cotton Curtain. And
above the Cotton Curtain?
In other words, we sold in the Deep South, but we didn't sell records in the far north, and we didn't sell in the far west.
So did people sometimes cover your records and try to beat you to the charts?
Like that song, Lonely, Lonely Nights, was a hit by Earl King. It was the second biggest R&B record of the year it came out, but on the west coast and other parts of the United States, it was a hit by Johnny Guitar Watson out of L.A., whereas we didn't even know such a record existed till we got to the record convention, and lo and behold, there was a cover record that had outsold the original by a lot of records in these other areas.
Did you hear a lot of fake New Orleans-style music during that period of people who'd really figured out how to copy what you were doing but really weren't doing it with the kind of emotion that you felt that you and your musicians were?
More what happened was I saw more and more New Orleans musicians being absconded from New Orleans and being taken to California, to New York, and all over the country. There were spaces of time where we'd get new studio drummers at one point. Charlie Hungry Williams, who was my favorite drummer of all of the New Orleans drummers, Mickey and Sylvia had stolen him from New Orleans and taken him to New York, at which point we had to find a new studio drummer. of which many great jazz drummers, like guys like Edward Blackwell and all these guys came in, and James Black, great other drummers came in that were jazz drummers to fill his shoes at that time. And until we finally would, I think John Boudreau wound up getting his gig. But prior to that, when Earl Palmer was taken to the West Coast, they had had to use two drummers on sessions to copy what he did. And so they figured rather than keep using two drummers to play these New Orleans drum parts, it was cheaper bringing Earl Palmer to California, which is what they did.
So it busted up the scene?
And no, it just it opened up a new door, and a new, and we got new drummers. Like that was what opened the door for Charlie Hungry Williams, and it was a great thing in its way. He wasn't a polished drummer like Earl Palmer was, but he was kind of the guy that was there at the time when more Latin rhythms came into the picture, and he was such a funky guy that it didn't come out sounding Latin, and this is what made it rock and roll drumming.
Once a lot of the studios wanted to hire away a lot of the New Orleans musicians, did you want to go? Did you leave at that point?
I didn't want to go because, in fact, the New Orleans scene was really falling apart fast in like 62, 63. The unions were freaked out about overdubbing. They would like came in and shut the studios down, and what all it did was there were new studios would open illegally around New Orleans, and we would get fined by the union for doing sessions. And it was like I was in a lot of trouble with the union. I was in a lot of trouble at the time. And the whole scene, a lot of the companies were at that time going to Memphis to record and going to other cities. And what had happened was the union did not understand the competitiveness of the record business and was chasing away all our business. And the guys in the band and in the label I had was working for at the time, which was AFO Records, All for One. It was the first musician-owned record company. They right away they had a hit record with Barbara George's I Know. It was like a number one record, and the first record you put out on a record company is a number one record, and everybody in the country was really hot about this label. And what happened, it was like there were no businessmen in this label. And right away, the first artist for AFO got gobbled up by other people. And the band all moved to California to work for Sam Cooke. Well, I was like the holdout guy. I didn't want to leave New Orleans. I was working a good gig there playing organ. Myself and James Booker were alternating, and Booker was teaching me how to play organ, and that was a real great experience for me. But these guys wanted me to go to California to play guitar because Ron Montrell, who had been my guitar teacher, had left the band to go with Jimmy Smith or whoever he had left with at the time. Well, I kept stalling and stalling. By the time I finally went, Sam Cooke was dead. The label was going, it was in serious trouble. Harold Baptiste and Melvin Lasty, the guys that I was working with at AFO, were then, like, Harold was working with Sonny and Cher. Melvin Lasty was doing stuff with Phil Spector, and it was all, like, when I got there, it was expecting to go do some rhythm and blues music and stuff I was more used to, and I walked into the psychedelic era or the a whole other thing, and it was really a culture shock at its worst.
Yeah, no, you went from this background of playing a music rooted in jazz and blues and early rock and roll, and then you became one of the leading figures in psychedelic music, and you'd created this persona for yourself, the Dr. John persona. How was that created? Was it your idea to do that?
Well, I had always came up with album concepts. I would think of like, well, this will be a project, and I would come up with like a lot of album projects so that if I had some work to do, that we'd have projects to fill in to do. And the Dr. John thing was, the Grigri album was one of the projects. I had envisioned taking Ronnie Barron, and who was a singer, and a guy that had worked with my band as a singer and a vibe player, and I was going to get him to be Dr. Jones. When I got to California, actually when I got him to California, he got hooked up with Don Costa, and Don didn't like the idea of him doing Dr. John thing as a career move. And I had been like trying to peddle the idea off for a few years in California. Nobody was interested. And lo and behold, we were doing an album. I was doing some work for Cher's album, and Sonny and Cher's record. They were doing a movie at the time and blowing a lot of studio time. And so as not to waste the studio time, Harold Baptiste said, well, let's just start doing one of your projects. And this is how we did the Grigri album.
How did you describe the Dr. John persona to people who you were trying to market it to before you did it yourself?
Well, what I would do was I would just lay out the picture. I would say, you know, this is going to be like a throwback to the old Snake Oil shows, and this is going to be a project that, and I would describe Ronnie Barron as a guy that was a good entertainer, but the idea was, at the time, there was no real shows that were out around. And the concept was to take all of the technology that I knew of show business from over the years, like throwing glitter to make the effect of magic, and using a lot of concepts that were easily and cheaply adaptable to show business and to make a show that would be real mystical in orientation for people. And it was a real, like, easy-to-do show. And all I had to do was to get a group of dancers, and I got all these people from New Orleans who were real familiar with that kind of music. And we did the album, and the show was geared to the snake dancers and all the regular voodoo shows of New Orleans. And unfortunately, when I first presented it, it was a little too authentic for the labels. They weren't quite ready for a guy biting a chicken's head off and stuff. So we modified the show down to a lot less authenticness, to more showbiz style, and took it on the road. And unfortunately, by the time when I finally did take it on the road, most of the guys were getting very comfortable in the studio scene in L.A., and less of them would come per tour. And at some point, I was like down to Didymus the percussionist and the background singers, and everybody else at one point was subs. But when it first started, it was a great show. I would have put that band up against anybody. I used to challenge any band that was on a gig with us to a battle of the bands. And whether it was Thelonious Monk or whoever it was, I knew these guys could hold their own with. And my idea was that to show people that we weren't just about show business, that we were real good musicians too.
I want to play something from one of your early Dr. John the Night Tripper records, and this is from the Grigri album, and it's Grigri Gumbo Yaya. Do you want to say anything about when you started doing this song and how you'd get into it?
Well, this was the introduction song. Like, on the show, I would step on a button and have a big puff of smoke and say, they call me, and as the smoke cleared, it would look like I had just popped up. You know, it's an old magic trick. And that was like the introduction song to our show. And this also was like introducing myself to the audience as who and what Dr. John is.
They call me Dr. John, known as the Night Tripper. Got my satchel of Grigri's in my hand. Dig me tripping up and back down the bayou. I'm the last of the best, they call me the greedy man. Got many clients, come from miles around, running down my prescription. I got medicine to cure all y'all's ills. I got remedies of every description. I got
green, green, green.
Here now. You got love troubles, you got a bad woman you can't control, I got just the thing for you. Something called controlling hearts and get-together drops. If you work too hard and you need a little rest, try my Easy Life Rub or put some of my Boss Fix Jam in your breakfast. Try a little bit of...
Now, I think you hadn't sung or at least recorded your singing before recording in the persona of Dr. John. Was it hard to find your own voice when you were doing Dr. John?
I literally had no voice. I'd never really sang other than a few risque songs after I was at clubs, but I'd never... The only thing I knew about singing was I knew how to sell songs as a songwriter. But I had no chops as a singer in any way, shape, or form. And I'm only recently kind of learning a little bit how to sing. And it's like way after the fact. And this has been a kind of a pattern in my life, learning on the job, training style. But like from the fact of knowing how to sell songs as a songwriter helped me get over where it... I knew I could do this and it would work after hearing Bob Dylan and Sonny Bono and people like that. I realized, well, they're not really singers. They're really guys that write lyrics and they put music to it, but they're not singers as such. And then I knew I was onto something when groups like the Temptations and the Four Tops started imitating these guys, and they were taking this non-singing style and adapting it, and it was like I knew that I was onto something when I heard this kind of thing happening.
What was your reaction to the psychedelic music scene? You'd come from a very different background.
I was very turned off by it. Like, even though this became most of the venues that I'd work in later, the whole scene in general, it was like, it was more to me like the vibe of everybody being into the oneness of the planet. Now, that was great, and the vibe, but it was like, also, coming from Louisiana and being very paranoid and very leery of surface things, I felt like, hey, this is something that doesn't sit quite right, and it doesn't feel like there must be some real scurvy thing happening behind the scenes that I was expecting to flounce out at any moment. And as that began to literally happen with the death of freeform radio and like the Vietnam War movement and things all going down real negatively, it started kind of coming to pass, and let's see, it kind of encouraged me to do like a record of Babylon talking about this, and it really set in my stomach. It's like Timothy Leary talking about tuning in, turning in, dropping off, and jumping off the edge of the planet is what it sounded like to me. It wasn't something so groovy sounding. And then I was watching the after effects of this. I mean, I'd see these runaway kids that would hook up with our band. And, like, I was around, like, the Diggers who were, like, feeding all these runaway kids in the parks. And it was real other side to this coin of all the love and the love beads and all was in the marketplace, but there were kids that out there starving and freezing and not covered and didn't know how to take care of themselves. And it was very fortunate that there were guys like the Diggers and the Panthers feeding these kids and taking care of them.
Were there a lot of misconceptions about who you were, because people knew you as Dr. John the Night Tripper before they knew? Well, I mean, your listeners in the late 60s knew about Dr. John the Night Tripper, and they didn't know about Mac Rebinac. They didn't know about your whole career before that, except for a few people who were very well-versed in music. But were there a lot of misconceptions that you think your listeners had about you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even my record company, Jerry Wexler, didn't know I played piano or who I was until I was doing my Remedies album for Atlantic, and Leon Russell brought him over to the studio. And here's one of the heads of my record company, didn't know I played the piano, and it was at which time he figured to do the Gumbo album with me. But prior to that, it was like I just took it for granted that people knew I was the same guy in the industry. I didn't really want people out of the industry to know anything was connected with anything, because I was like living a double life, so to speak, as a record producer working for Mercury and keeping that separate with Harold Baptiste as a record producer and arranger and all for one company, and then working as an artist for another company. And I didn't want the two things to get caught up together in any way. Unfortunately for me, that all came to a head at a little later point, in which it kind of all backfired in my face. And
what happened?
Well, as it all started to come out with some articles that I was Mac Rebinac and Dr. John was one guy, it became a whole slew of problems for me, where I had papers that didn't allow me to do one thing or two things that I was doing at the same time, and I got involved with lawsuits. I got involved with quite a few problems that came out of all of this. That I got in quite a bit of trouble with the police, with drugs and stuff like this, and all of it kind of was crashing down on me at once.
Did you want to give up the Dr. John the Night Tripper persona then?
No, it wasn't anything to do with giving up anything. I just, it was like I wanted to try to figure a way to regroup things, though, and take, it was like taking this show on the road was costing me money at a point. It was literally not only not paying off for me to, where I wasn't making a living, I was actually losing money putting the show on. It's like the road takes its toll on everything. When we had a show with all these gimmicks and things, and these were all early on things, today people have a lot more sturdy machinery. When you see groups out there with strobe lights and all of the things, or now they might have lasers and things, but back then we were making things up as we went along, and it was costly, because I had a few guys that were from schools that were helping me do things very cheap, and as I would lose one or two of these guys, the price of everything was getting exorbitant, and just keeping the show on the road was out of hand. So as I was cutting down the show, I realized I was going to have to make some drastic changes. And unfortunately, I didn't make some very sensible changes. Like, I changed the Grigri show into New Orleans Mardi Gras show, which was eliminated a lot of carrying snakes on the road and carrying smoke bombs and all this other stuff. But I didn't have the sense to make the group smaller and do some things that would have made some real sensible moves, but autistic people is not necessarily, you know, money-conscious people.
Do you feel that the Dr. John and the Mac Rebinac parts of you are united now?
Yeah, I never ever felt any separation between the two things. I used to just believe that due to contractual problems that I had to keep things separate to the world at large. But it was to you know, I was the same guy doing whatever I did, and it was like very dumb moves that I made to try to hide some of the things that I was doing, like change the show to the Rhythm and Blues Review show. And at what point that I did this, I was like hiding behind guys in my band and trying to present a package show where club owners could book one group and they could perform two or three shows. And it worked for a few minutes, but all of a sudden these people were saying, well, we booked Dr. Joan, and all of a sudden you're giving us Ronnie Barron, Alvin Robinson, the Creolettes, and these were not acts with any hot records. At the time, I had somewhat of a hot record and was doing a small part of my own show. But I was presenting something that I thought was unique at the time and was another element that was something that was something, a part of music that was not being delivered by anybody. And unfortunately, I had chosen a space and a time to do this all, and it was backfired in my face.
You were born Roman Catholic. What got you so interested in voodoo?
Well, it's a real heavy part of New Orleans scene. When I was coming up, it was like, everybody I know, it's like you automatically, whether it was my grandmother or my grandfather, everybody did certain little gree-gree things. It was like the herbal remedies we took as a kid were strictly gree-gree things, like that what they gave us to teeth as babies, and all these things were strictly gree-gree remedies. And I'd say a great bulk of what gree-gree is in Louisiana is homeopathic medicine. And I don't think people, they look at the spells and the stuff, but that's a side of something, and it's a very small part of what gree-gree is about in Louisiana. That there's a very large part of it that's just connected with the African and Indian, like folk remedies and things, and it's just part of the culture. I don't.
You were studying to be a priest in the Church of Voodoo and Witchcraft?
Well, what I actually did was legalize it. I chartered it so that the Reverend Mothers in New Orleans would not be busted for fortune telling, for doing spells, and whatever they did prior to me having got a charter with the state of Louisiana. All these Reverend Mothers, who were some of the best people I ever knew, were getting busted on a regular basis for just going to hospitals and helping people, and it was ridiculous. With several of them talked to me, well, you did this gree-gree album. They didn't want me to do some of the authentic gree-gree music, which I had been asking them to do for a few years, but they had let me do an album kind of making a picture of it and helped me in a lot of ways. And that was kind of my way of returning the favor by getting this charter for them.
So you created the church to help legitimize their activities?
And it worked real well. It's like to this day they still can use this charter. And a lot of the Reverend Mothers, even not in the state of Louisiana, have chartered this in other states, in Florida and in Tennessee and Mississippi and Alabama.
You know what I wanted to ask you about that I forgot to bring up earlier when you were talking about playing at the clubs? I had read somewhere that you were shot in the fingers, I think, during a club date. What happened? What's the story with that?
Well, I was playing a gig in Jacksonville, Florida, and Ronnie Barron, who was singing with our band at the time, he was, like, really underage. He was, like, a couple of years younger than me. And his mother had told me, look, you look out for Ronnie. And I remembered how guys had looked out for me when I was first out there. Well, I went to get Ronnie for a gig. I walk in the room, and this guy's pistol whipping him over, like, a jealous lover scene. And I went to try to get the gun out the guy's hand. And in doing it, I got my finger over the barrel instead of the handle of the gun. And as I hit the guy's hand on a rock to get the gun out of his hand, went off and blew the tip of my finger off. And I was fortunate they were able to sew the tip back on, but it's like affected me from being a guitar player. And it really took a toll. I really feel a lot of the contribution of me getting into drugs was out of connected with this incident, that I was very depressed about not being able to follow my career as a guitarist. And even though I went into playing keyboards and other things that worked out later, there was a long space of time when I was very, like, I had just geared my life to being a guitar player, and all of a sudden that was, like, gone, and it really messed my whole head up.
Is that one of the things that got you into playing more piano?
Yeah, I first went to playing bass and back to playing drums, and then I had to work one summer playing, like, bass with the Dixieland Band in New Orleans, and then I began playing organ, and James Booker started teaching me to play organ at Madame Francine's Club and taught me how to play the foot pedals. And that really was one of the special times of my life, was to work with Booker. And it was like not only a learning process of the organ, but Booker was another great teacher for me as far as everything to do with keyboards. And later on, when he worked with the Dr. John group and all, he was always such a, I consider him the greatest New Orleans keyboard player out of all of them that I knew, and maybe the only guy I ever knew that was a genius.
My guest is Dr. John MacRebenack. You know, one of the things I want to ask you about briefly, which I know you've been doing lately, is singing jingles for commercials on television. Can you just tick off a list of some of the ones you've done?
Well, right now, Scott's Tissue Paper is one of them, and Oreo Cookies and Cream, Popeye's Chicken, and God, I'm so bad. I just did one for Old Timey Lemonade.
Is there a certain kind of product that they assume you're going to be perfect for?
I'm always surprised that they pick me for anything. It's like when I did a thing for Sanka Coffee and a thing for a beer company, the two products seem so, like, coffee and beer. Why would they pick me to sell these two products? But I didn't know that neither one knew that the other guy was hiring me. But it seems like it's more to do with guys from the musical end know me. And they said, well, whose voice would fit this commercial? And usually they'll call me in and talk to me about it and say, well, you know, does this seem cool?
Are you having problems with imitators? I know there's a lot of sound-alikes now that are getting gigs that would have gone to the original voice, but it's cheaper to get the imitator.
Well, also, a couple of the guys are friends of mine. One of the guys that used to do the scratch tracks for me for Popeye's Chicken is now doing a lot of them himself. And I'm glad to see he's getting to work. And, like, I got mixed feelings about it in a lot of ways. And it's a joke between a few of us. And another guy that's a bass playing friend of mine, Will Lee, who's doing some things. He like, does, I guess you could say, like, parodies of me. And I get a kick out of it because it's like, if it wasn't somebody that were friends, and I know they could use the work too, then I might have different feelings about it. But so far, I feel cool about that.
A couple of your latest albums really showcase your piano playing. Have you been seeing yourself as much of a pianist now as a singer or guitarist or producer or any of the other things that you've done?
Actually, I just have always looked at myself as just a musician. It plays in the rhythm section. I feel very awkward being called a piano player, a something, because what I do is, like, not necessarily I'm not a great piano player, so to speak. I can play the piano, and I love to play the piano. I love to play music. But I just as much love to play the guitar, the bass, or the drums, or anything else in a rhythm section. And that's really my love. I feel very awkward making piano solo records because there's no interplay. And I always thought of doing something like that as like the end of the rope. From there, I'm stuck with playing the Holiday Inn circuit for the rest of my life, and I'll be in some little club, somebody drunkenly asking me to play Melancholy Baby or something, and that was my vision of this. Well, it didn't go that way, but that's a real underlying fear with this kind of thing to guys like me who've seen that happen to friends.
What would you really like now to happen with your career?
Well, I'm hoping to make a record with my present band and doing some new material that I feel real confident about. I have two or three projects that I'd like to do with myself as an artist. One of the projects that I had in mind we just recently did with some other artists. In fact, I'll say it was Jimmy Witherspoon. And some of the other stuff that I was starting to hook up for another project, did one of the songs on Hank Crawford's album. But it's like sooner or later we'll get a shot to do a record. And when I do, I intend to do one of these projects as an opening project in the hopes of getting not necessarily a huge hit record, but to just get enough of a record that gets enough attention that my band can get more work and, you know, I can keep the guys a little happier by gigging more.
I want to play a piece in which you're featured at the piano. It's a composition that you wrote called Dorothy. Would you say a little bit about it before we hear it?
Well, it's a song that I had recorded on my first album for AFO Records as a piano instrumental in 1961 that I had written for my mother. And it was a very gospel-oriented song, and it reminds me very much of not only my mother, but the whole kind of Christian music scene that she came out of. And I think it's very much to do with the old spiritual church music of New Orleans.
Why don't we end with your composition, Dorothy? My guest, Dr. John MacRebinack, at the piano. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed this.